dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas, and Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney. I'm pleased to have with me a man who was covering for me in my absence in Israel for part of this past week and regular here at Secure Freedom Radio. He's Bill Gertz, prize-winning national security correspondent, now a senior writer and editor for the Washington Free Beacon, also the author of the splendid Inside the Ring column of the Washington Times. Bill, welcome back.
Hi, Frank. Good to be on the program. Welcome back to you.
Thank you. Bill, you've been reporting on the implications of the government shutdown and default, both domestically to some extent, but particularly internationally. And maybe we could start with that. China, how is this being seen from over there, and what might the repercussions be?
Well, it's very serious. The president canceled a four-nation visit to Asia that included two summits, the ASEAN summit and the East Asia summit, as well as a number of bilateral meetings with heads of states of key Southeast Asian nations, namely Philippines and Malaysia, who are feeling the pinch from China. China is making vast territorial claims over the South China Sea. I think they claim 90% of it. Obviously, Philippines, Malaysia, other states, Vietnam, are challenging those claims. And this was going to be a good opportunity for the president to make the presence felt to secure those friends and allies who feel threatened by China. And of course, the president initially decided to cut back the trip, only go to two nations and leave off Malaysia and Philippines, and then decided, after all, to cancel the entire trip. By contrast, Chinese President Xi Jinping traveled to Indonesia and Malaysia and sought to shore up China's presence there. Now, the Chinese are fairly isolated now because so many nations don't feel comfortable and feel threatened by their growing military and maritime surveillance ships encroachment in that region. So the word from officials is that there are clear signs that the Asia pivot is struggling as a result of Obama's lack of leadership there.
Yeah. Well, I must tell you, as we've discussed on numerous occasions over the past year or so, I never thought there was much there anyway. But I think you're right. This is probably simply bearing that out in a very tangible way. Bill, you've also written about the Chinese who have considerable equities stashed here in the United States, personal wealth, beginning to fear the unraveling of our economy. Talk a little bit about that and what, again, that might mean ultimately, perhaps for, among other things, the reserve currency of the world status we've enjoyed.
Yeah, the Chinese are getting very nervous about a potential U.S. default on as a result of the debt ceiling not being raised. The deadline's looming, I think it's next Thursday, and the Chinese have about $1.3 trillion parked in U.S. securities and other debt holdings. And a lot of that comes from the ruling elite, the princelings, the offspring of communist rulers and other industrialists who don't even trust their own Chinese banks to keep their money, so they keep it here. So everybody's been watching closely what China's been doing this. A key Chinese finance official came out and criticized the U.S. This week. He said the U.S. had been irresponsibly spending for years and that they need to protect the international financial system. They're warning that there could be dire problems if the U.S. doesn't raise the debt limit and solve its financial house.
It almost certainly, as our friend Kevin Freeman, among others, have been warning, is going to be a further impetus behind their Chinese, that is, efforts to supplant the dollar as the reserve currency of the world if they can. They may still have a banking problem, but if they can make their currency rather than ours, the reserve, it will definitely advance their strategic objectives, their financial interests as well. Again, our guest is Bill Gertz, the author of the Inside the Ring column at the Washington Times, and also, of course, a senior editor at the Washington Free Beacon, the author of numerous best-selling books, among them on China and the U.S. government's relationship with it. But let me turn to Libya, Bill. You've written about the raid that was recently successfully accomplished by the special operators of the United States to seize and bring to justice the terrorist who has been believed responsible for a number of attacks against American interests and equities and personnel for some time, Abu al-Libi. Going on there, and most especially, what was happening with the capture and the sudden release of the prime minister of Libya, and are there others that might be in the offing?
Yeah, this is a very unstable time for Libya. They really don't have a solid government in Tripoli, and instead they have numerous jihadist militias, many of them connected to al-Qaeda. They've reacted harshly to the commando raid that was conducted the past weekend to capture Abu Anas al-Libi, who was behind the 1998 bombings of U.S. embassies in Tanzania and Kenya, killing 247 people, including 12 Americans. There's been a reaction now online. Social media has threatened to kidnap U.S. journalists and try and hold them and exchange them for al-Libi. Other threats are that the terrorists will attack U.S. interests in the region. And one rebel group called for the ouster of the president, and shortly after that call, he was kidnapped temporarily and then released. So things are getting pretty hot over there. I also reported earlier a very significant story that this raid on al-Libi, who had been dormant for probably a decade, also may have undermined efforts to capture the terrorists who are operating in the open out there behind the Benghazi raid of September 2012. So this has certainly driven a lot of suspects to ground, and a lot of critics are saying, you know, oh, look, we've got this high-value detainee. Why didn't we make the effort, a bigger effort, to go after these other guys?
And is there a good answer to that?
Senior administration official told me that, don't worry, we're focused like a laser on bringing those behind the Benghazi attack to justice. However, as we've seen with these recent threats and the temporary capture of the Libyan prime minister, that clearly things are it's not going to be easy to do a second raid in Libya.
Yeah, no kidding. Diffuse laser at best. Let me ask about the prime minister. Is there any scuttlebutt as to why they think he was released so swiftly? It would seem he would have been a great bargaining chip in all of this.
Yes, that's for sure. My guess is that the Libyan government has close connections to the rebels that did it or others, and made it very clear to them that they had the ability to make their life a living hell if they didn't do that. So that's the only way that those people respond to those kinds of threats.
Indeed.
But I don't know that for certain.
Yeah. No, it sounds like a sensible thought. Today, the Nobel Committee announced that the Peace Prize this year would go to the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons. This is the outfit, of course, that at the moment is much in the news because it's trying to get their hands on and help dismantle the chemical stockpile of Syria. What do you make of this award and organization?
Well, you know, this organization has been around a long time. It's a rather toothless organization when it comes to chemical weapons, as we've seen in Syria, you know, recently, the fact that they've been using chemical weapons on at least 12 occasions shows that negotiating your way to a chemical weapons-free world hasn't worked. That said, it's hoped that the dismantlement of Syrian chemical weapons will go ahead. We've got inspectors in the country right now. It's going to be a very difficult challenge. The officials that I talk to say the two big problems are, one, you have the Russians being a key guarantor for the Syrian dismantlement. And the second problem is that most of the chemical weapons depots are not in areas that are securely controlled by government troops. They're in the northern and eastern part of the country where the rebels are very active. So it's clear to me that the rebels very well could make a run at some of those depots. They're known. There are maps out there on the internet showing where the Syrian chemical depots are, and these are kept in binary form, then they're mixed together, and then they become deadly nerve agent blisters. So this is a serious problem. I hope that we can get through with this chemical weapons dismantlement, but I'm not optimistic.
Yeah, I think it's going to be a very hard push. Their recognition for their efforts perhaps is warranted, but it certainly, as with giving President Obama the Peace Prize shortly after he took office, probably premature. Bill Gertz, thank you as always for the reporting you do on all of these subjects and for joining us each week, and for guest hosting on my behalf earlier this week. Keep up the good work, my friend. Next up, the horrific practice of rape as a weapon of war, and what one organization is trying to do to help the victims in the Democratic Republic of Congo.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
An inspector general serves as an independent watchdog in each federal agency, promoting integrity and efficiency while rooting out fraud, waste, and abuse of authority in our government. Several important U.S. agencies have not had an IG for years, including the State Department, which has been without an IG for 5 years. During a constant wave of scandals in Washington, D.C., the newly published IG handbook couldn't be more timely. Every IG takes an oath to support and defend the Constitution against all enemies, foreign and domestic. By exposing fraud, waste, or abuse through audits, IGs satisfy the constitutional mandate that a regular statement and account of the receipts and expenditures of all public money shall be published from time to time. The new IG handbook explains by what authority and for what purpose an inspector general does what he or she does on behalf of we, the people. Find the Inspector General Handbook by yours truly, Joseph E. Schmitz, on Amazon.com.
Hey, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real special forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real special forces, ours need ammunition. And in the war of ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
I'm Robert Muse, co-founder and senior counsel of the American Freedom Law Center, our nation's premier public interest law firm fighting for your faith and freedom in courtrooms across America. Make no mistake, we live in a pivotal time. Secular progressives such as Barack Obama and his surrogates are zealously sweeping religion from the public square, foisting Sharia law and other harmful international precedents into our courts and constitution, assaulting the traditional family, and weakening our national defense by, among other things, undermining the strength of our military through social engineering and political correctness. But I can assure you that the American Freedom Law Center is aggressively engaging our nation's enemies with offensive lawfare to defend our fundamental rights and to fight stealth jihad in all of its forms, including the civilization jihad being waged by Muslim Brotherhood front groups operating here in the U.S. Indeed, there is no other public interest law firm as uniquely qualified to fight this battle. But we need your prayers and financial support to succeed. Please consider a tax-deductible donation to support our critical fight for your faith and freedom. Visit us at www.AmericanFreedomLawCenter.org.
If you don't know where Bill Bennett stands, here are some of his beliefs.
I believe Americans should largely do much more for themselves than many Americans are doing.
But do I rule out government as something that might be able to assist in that? And that I do not.
I do think families, churches, and schools are better places for that to happen. People should do for themselves what they can. Government should do what people cannot do for themselves.
Get to know Bill Bennett, weekday mornings from 6 to 9 on 1260 WRC. New Choice, Intelligent Talk.
Listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
back. We're visiting with Leanne DeRouche. She is the co-founder of a foundation in the Democratic Republic of Congo that is doing such important work that it was nominated in the person of its medical director at a hospital there for the Nobel Peace Prize. Did not receive it, worthy though the Panzi Foundation and its Dr. Dennis Mukwege are. But we are very privileged to be visiting with the co-founder of that foundation, Dr. DeRouche, and to talk a little bit about the kind of work that is made necessary by what's going on in the Democratic Republic of Congo. Leanne DeRouche is an assistant professor at the Penn State University in Altoona. She is a scholar activist, as she puts it, including one that has been prominently featured in a book by John Prendergast entitled The Enough Moment, Fighting to End Africa's Worst Human Rights Crimes. Dr. DeRouche, welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. Thank you for the work you're doing. Let's talk a little bit about the Panzi Foundation, why you started it, and what would have brought it to the attention of the Nobel Peace Prize Committee.
Well, thank you so much, Frank, for the opportunity. It's a pleasure to be on your show with you this morning. Panzi Foundation USA was started at the request of Dr. Dennis Mukwege, who is the medical director and chief surgeon at Panzi Hospital in Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo. Prior to our involvement, had no entity or proper facility within the United States through which he could work. In other words, people in the United States knew about his hospital, his work, wanted to help and support, but there was no means for people, for example, to make a tax-deductible donation.
So this is kind of a support network for the important work that we're about to learn more of. We're visiting with Dr. Leanne DeRouche. She is the co-founder of a marvelous organization that is helping incredibly important work on what I think of as the front lines of the war for the free world, the Democratic Republic of Congo, to be specific. And Dr. Rishi, you're talking a bit about the sort of funding arm that you've created for Dr. Dennis Mukwege in the Democratic Republic of Congo. What is it that he's doing that warrants the philanthropy of Americans and is and garnering it in considerable quantities?
Well, that's a really good question. It's amazing the work that Dr. Mukwege is doing. His hospital treats over 1,200 survivors of sexual violence each year who make it to Bukavu to his hospital seeking treatment for their injuries due to sexual violence, usually rape. It's more than just medical care, however. A woman can also receive legal support. She can receive economic or be involved with economic empowerment programs. And part of what we do in our mission is to support an aftercare program for women. Many who have finished treatment at the hospital have nowhere to go because they've been rejected by their husbands or families or villages due to the terrible stigma that's associated with sexual violence. And unable to read or write, or maybe without means of an income, it's difficult for them to support themselves and their children.
Right.
So there's an aftercare facility that we help raise the funds for that offers classes for women in, for example, learning French or Swahili so they can become literate. There are also programs about nutrition, any sort of educational program you can imagine. And then there are also a skills-based training program so that when a woman leaves this program, she's able to hopefully find a job and some means for supporting herself and her family.
This really is an act of enormous compassion, obviously, for women who have suffered brutally. Talk a little bit about why this is epidemic at the moment, this sexual violence against women in the Democratic Republic of Congo. Who's perpetrating this? And is this part of the war that's being waged against the population there?
It's a really good question, and it's also quite complex. The playing field seems to change often, but you have multiple foreign fighters, armed groups that are there. And the basis for some of those armed groups years ago comes from after the genocide that happened in Rwanda in 1994. And some of the perpetrators of the genocide fled over the border into eastern Congo to avoid prosecution in Rwanda. They set up shop in eastern Congo, and now they've kind of morphed into a variety of groups. But, you know, you have rampant poverty in eastern Congo at the same time as it's one of the most natural resource-rich nations in the world. And part of what they have are these some of the largest deposits of the what we call conflict minerals, which are the minerals that are used in all electronic devices. So, and this is a gross oversimplification, but you have a lot of armed groups, some Congolese, some non-Congolese, who have taken over these mineral mines or are extracting the minerals, illegally getting them onto the black market and ultimately into the supply chain. But this, and then into our electronic devices. But the minerals prove to be very profitable. Well, unfortunately, it's the citizens that end up being in the way, primarily women.
And Dr. Mukwege has found himself really in the middle of this conflict and doing, as I said, enormously important work trying to rehabilitate these women. But to what extent, yes, I'm really trying to get at, are you seeing in the DRC a practice that's now become sort of commonplace in so many conflicts around the world of using sexual violence against women as a means of, well, destroying the fabric of the society or driving people out of a specific area, enabling them to control, as you say, resources and so on? I mean, talk a little bit about, you know, the underlying brutal logic that's being applied here that uses this weapon in this fashion.
Well, yes, and this is complicated, but it's also the it's such a crucial question. Why is rape happening at these unprecedented levels? Nothing, we've never seen anything like this ever historically. I mean, literally hundreds of thousands of women and girls have been raped in eastern Congo since 1998, and it's multi-layered. So sexual violence is clearly the outcome. So what are the root causes? Part of it is that, as you mentioned, these armed groups know that rape and is a tactic for destroying the morale. War, I think, is language that I try to avoid simply because I think it obscures a lot of these complexities that actually are that are behind this. So think about what we have here, the conditions. It's eastern Congo. There's rampant poverty. There is no, you have a failed state. There is virtually no infrastructure. You have a hugely traumatized population. Everyone has, lives have been touched by the violence in some way. That trauma is not being dealt with. And when you think about what sexual violence is about, rape is about power and control. So what's happening is you've got a lot of disempowered individuals who suffer from trauma. They are hungry. They are suffering from poverty, who are trying to gain control either in their own lives or of a region, trying to acquire wealth. And so it's become, and when you've got impunity for these crimes, you've got, it's become, unfortunately, a common tactic.
Indeed.
For
Dr. Darush, I'm afraid we have to leave it at that. I appreciate enormously the work that the Panzi Foundation USA is doing in supporting Dr. Dennis Mukwege. I'm sorry that the Nobel Committee decided not to recognize that other than as kind of a runner-up for the Peace Prize. But congratulations on that recognition at least. And for all you're doing on behalf of all of us, thank you. Keep it up, and we'll hope to get an update from you in the future as well. Next up, another humanitarian organization doing splendid work on behalf of our fallen men and women in uniform and their families. The Fisher House Foundation, straight ahead.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Thank you.
Hugh Hewitt keeps the Constitution first.
That's what the left is about right now. Not about this or that.
Regulation or restriction.
Not about keeping weapons out of the hands of the mentally disabled. It's about attacking the Constitution. And by the way, you cannot mess with the Second Amendment without messing with the First and the Fourth and the Fifth and the Tenth. You either respect the Constitution or you don't.
The Hugh Hewitt Show. Weeknights at 6 after Michael Medved at 3 on 1260 WRC. New Choice. Intelligent Talk.
This is Jenny Thomas. I do video interviews of leaders with the Daily Caller. I had the privilege recently of interviewing Diana West about her extraordinary new book, American Betrayal, The Secret Assault on Our Nation's Character. You can see it at dailycaller.com. American Betrayal reads like a spellbinding historical thriller, but it is also a carefully documented account of how the U.S. government was penetrated by communist agents in the years after President Roosevelt normalized relations with the Soviet Union. Diana West shows how a similar assault is being mounted today by yet another collectivist ideology, the supremacist Islamic doctrine of Sharia. She establishes that while the communists and the Islamists may have very different visions of the world, they have employed the same techniques to defeat America. Please watch my conversation with Diana West about American Betrayal, then check out the other great leaders we profile at dailycaller.com.
This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Last week, I was on the Golan Heights, a mountainous area where Israel and Syria meet. In Israeli hands, this bitterly contested frontier has nonetheless, for the past four decades, been one of the world's most quiet. I could hear heavy weapons fire from Syria's civil war in the distance, though, and this week, some 200 of Bashar Assad's armored vehicles have been shooting at rebel forces so close to the border that two Israeli soldiers were injured yesterday. The last time massed Syrian armor fired on the Golan was to launch the 1973 Yom Kippur War. Ever since it won, Israel has been told to return the heights to Assad. Had the Israelis foolishly done so instead of a civil war in Syria, the next regional conflict might already have started. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Learn more at securefreedom.org.
The Devil We Don't Know by Noni Darwish uncovers the dark side of revolution in the Middle East and the reason why Muslim countries are unable to dig themselves out of a cycle of revolution, political unrest, and tyranny. The constitutions of many Muslim countries state that Sharia law supersedes all other law, and that is why it has failed in providing a legal and political system where healthy democracy can flourish. In this dynamic, only tyrannical governments can survive. In The Devil We Don't Know, human rights activist and Center for Security Policy fellow Noni Darwish answers the tough questions. Why the Arab Spring won't usher in freedom and democracy or a feminist movement, and how Israel will be threatened by the new wave of Islamism after the so-called Arab Spring. The Devil We Don't Know by Noni Darwish. It's available at Amazon.com.
An inspector general serves as an independent watchdog in each federal agency, promoting integrity and efficiency while rooting out fraud, waste, and abuse of authority in our government. Several important U.S. agencies have not had an IG for years, including the State Department, which has been without an IG for 5 years. During a constant wave of scandals in Washington, D.C., the newly published IG handbook couldn't be more timely. Every IG takes an oath to support and defend the Constitution against all enemies, foreign and domestic. By exposing fraud, waste, or abuse through audits, IGs satisfy the constitutional mandate that a regular statement and account of the receipts and expenditures of all public money shall be published from time to time. The new IG handbook explains by what authority and for what purpose an inspector general does what he or she does on behalf of we, the people. Find the Inspector General Handbook by yours truly, Joseph E. Schmitz, on Amazon.com.
Hi, this is Frank Affney. You're listening to Intelligent Talk on WRC 1260 in Washington, D.C.
Now more with Frank Affney.
We are profiling in this segment of Secure Freedom Radio a marvelous organization, one that I have admired for a long time, that has generally shunned great deal of public recognition. Certainly, its founders and sponsors, the Fisher family, but they have done incalculably important work on behalf of our military men and women and their families, particularly those who have been harmed in the course of their service to our country. We're very pleased to have with us to talk about that work the president of the Fisher House Foundation. He is David Coker, formerly with the United States Army, a specialist in health care administration, which has obviously come in handy in the really remarkable and now it seems burgeoning contribution that Fisher House is making to the care of, as I say, both those in uniform who've been injured and their families. And I just can't thank you enough, David Coker, for what you all are doing and delighted to be able to share with our audience a bit of that work. Welcome. Glad to have you with us.
Well, thank you, Frank. It is our privilege.
So before we get into some of the dramatic developments of the government shutdown and the role that Fisher House has kind of been thrust into in that connection, talk a little bit about the organization, how it came about, your own role in getting it started, really, and what kind of work it has done in the interval since that founding.
Well, ours is a program that was actually designed in peacetime. It goes back to 1990. And it was at that time when our founder, Zach Fisher, went to Admiral Carl Trost and said, you know, I would like to do something that would bless the men and women serving in all of our armed forces. What would be a blessing? And being the tremendous leader that he is, Admiral Trost went to his wife and said, I've got a very generous offer. Let's give them the right answer. And they went back to Zach and said, you know, we need something kind of like a Ronald McDonald House. And Zach said, I'm a builder. I can do that. And he offered two houses, one at Walter Reed, one at Bethesda. And as those were being built, he said, you know, I don't want to make the Air Force mad. Offered one to the Air Force, and they said, we would love such a resource, but it needs to be in San Antonio. And three became five, became eight. At the heart of our program will always be the houses. Those original two houses supported 14 families. Today we have 62 houses, not only across the country, but we've got two in Germany, and we just opened one up in the United Kingdom to support our British allies.
And David Coker, you say they support the families. How exactly is that done in a specific way, if you can?
Well, if you think about it, when somebody is wounded, ill, or injured, they want two things. They want the best health care possible, and they want to be there. While the military and VA health care systems do a wonderful job of providing world-class health care, but sometimes the challenge is providing supportive, comfortable, cost-effective lodging for these families for an extended period. And that's where Fisher House comes in. Many times we're asked, well, why doesn't the government just do this? And number one, they need to focus on providing the health care. And the second part of that is it gives us the opportunity to come and bless these families and be a part of the solution.
Yeah.
They wouldn't do it the same way we do.
Well, if they could do it at all in a period of sequestration and cutbacks and now shutdown, obviously this would be really problematic. But it's being done by the private sector through the generosity and work of the Fisher family and their foundation, which you lead. And talk, if you would, a little bit about, well, maybe a specific example, if you've got one, of a family member turning up. They've just learned that one of their, no longer peacetime, now in time of war, one of their family members has just been badly injured, going off to one of the hospitals where you have this facility. How does it operate? What service do you provide that family in support of them at a very difficult moment in their lives?
Well, when we build these houses, we give them as a gift to the appropriate service, the Army, Navy, the Air Force, and the Secretary agrees they will operate and maintain it in perpetuity. Because they are now operated as a non-appropriated fund instrument on that side of the house, they are not affected by the government shutdown at all, and they continue to operate. But it also allows them to become a part of that healthcare system so that the doctors, the nurses, as soon as somebody goes in and gets ready to be admitted to the hospital, they're made aware of the resource. But one of the things that has happened through this process, we've learned a lot from the people who've graced our houses. We always want to build every house a little bit better, but we also learn where other unmet needs are. And you know, I mentioned before, people want to be there. One of the things we learned is that there was difficulty many times in getting to the loved one's bedside. And that allowed us to create a program called Hero Miles, where people donate their frequent flyer miles. We pool them. We pay the security fees. And we can supplement, and we work with the Department of Defense and the casualty system to bring additional family members and give the family the flexibility they need to support their loved one throughout the process. Because those who are most catastrophically injured, you know, the first stop for those deployed overseas is going to be Landstuhl. But if they can't be stabilized, we have two Fisher houses over there.
Wow. Let me ask you, Dr. Coker, because I know that people are going to want to learn more about Fisher House Foundation, what's the way that you would recommend they do so and find out particularly about how they might help?
Well, the best thing is to go to our website, and that's fisherhouse.org. Okay. There you can learn about where the houses are. You can learn who to contact at the houses if somebody wants to volunteer. You can learn about Hero Miles and our scholarship program and all the good things we're doing.
Wonderful. Now, David Coker, you mentioned the shutdown. You mentioned Fisher House operations not being affected by it. In fact, as I understand it, you've kind of assumed additional responsibility in the midst of all of this, at least until the death benefits to the families of U.S. military personnel legislation was recently signed into law by the president. Talk a little bit about how you stepped into the breach in the midst of the shutdown for the folks who have actually lost their loved ones.
Well, it was earlier this week when we learned of the halt of the death gratuity and the situation the families were in. And that morning I had called to speak with our chairman, Ken Fisher, who continues Zach's legacy. We had decided, you know, this is something that cannot stand. And part of that goes back, you know, Zach was an amazing man, and he would say, I just want to let you know from a grateful American how much I appreciate your loved one's sacrifice. And with that, he would include a personal check for $10,000 to $25,000 to tide them over until benefits kicked in. So this is a natural extension of something the family has done for years. And when the current conflict began, they did it again through the Intrepid Fallen Heroes Fund. But we needed to meet the need today, and to have the families who are dealing with such a tragic loss also bear additional financial burdens is something that cannot stand. They need to know that there are Americans across this country who are grateful for their loved one's service and appreciate it. And so shortly after we had had that conversation, we got a call from Senator Manchin, and he had asked if he knew the Fisher legacy, asked if we'd consider helping, and we said absolutely. And so within a couple of hours, the offer was extended to Secretary Hagel, and we have worked with the Department of Defense, have signed an agreement, a letter of agreement, allowing us to make the payments that the government would otherwise make.
Well, this is just one of innumerable examples of service to our country and to the men and women who defend it, for which we'll never adequately be able to say thank you. But permit me to try. David Coker, for the work that you and the House Foundation do, please, folks, find out more about it at fisherhouse.org. Contribute miles or financially or in any other way to its splendid work. And thank you again for you and the Fisher family and your commitment to securing freedom. We'll look forward to visiting with you in the future. And in the meantime, pray that you will keep up this splendid work.
Thank you so much, Frank. And thanks to your listeners for allowing us to be in the position to make a difference.
My pleasure, sir. Next up, Suzanne Schulte on another humanitarian nightmare. It's called North Korea. Straight ahead.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
a reason Bill Bennett doesn't go after people that disagree with him.
I don't think you persuade people when you yell at them.
When you make fun of them.
When you wave your finger and scold them. I don't think you turn anybody around. And I think the reason that you try to adopt the Socratic maxims of
candor, intelligence, and goodwill
is because people can change their minds.
They're not going to change their minds if you call them idiots.
I just don't think so.
Bill Bennett's Morning in America. Weekday mornings from 6 to 9 on 1260 WRC. New choice. Intelligent talk.
This is Frank Gaffney. Something is seriously wrong when the FBI interviews a jihadist like Tamerlan Tsarnaev, the older of the two Chechens believed to have perpetrated the bombing of the Boston Marathon, and sees no evil. Yet, that is the predictable result of the shackling of the Bureau that has taken place in recent years. For example, in 2011, the Obama administration actually purged FBI training materials of information that warns of the connection between the Tsarnaev's kind of religious fervor and terrifying acts of jihad. And Team Obama has also effectively told the Bureau it must get the approval of Muslim Brotherhood operatives before it can do any such training in the future. This is a formula for much more jihad in America. It's time to free the FBI so that they can do their job and protect our country. If you agree, go to www.freethefbi.com. That's www.freethefbi.com.
Hey, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the war of ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
This is Jenny Thomas. I do video interviews of leaders with the Daily Caller. I had the privilege recently of interviewing Diana West about her extraordinary new book, American Betrayal, The Secret Assault on Our Nation's Character. You can see it at dailycaller.com. American Betrayal reads like a spellbinding historical thriller, but it is also a carefully documented account of how the U.S. government was penetrated by communist agents in the years after President Roosevelt normalized relations with the Soviet Union. Diana West shows how a similar assault is being mounted today by yet another collectivist ideology, the supremacist Islamic doctrine of Sharia. She establishes that while the communists and the Islamists may have very different visions of the world, they have employed the same techniques to defeat America. Please watch my conversation with Diana West about American Betrayal, then check out the other great leaders we profile at dailycaller.com.
Michael Medved says stupidity in our federal government is a bipartisan issue.
This administration and the leadership of Barack Obama
and the leadership of some folks in the Republican Party
are both so stupid and just so inane and brain dead. Can you see some kind of bright side here?
Stupid is, stupid does, sir.
The Michael Medved Show.
You want to help me with this?
Afternoons from 3 to 6 on 1260 WRC. New choice. Intelligent talk.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. One of my favorite people in the world is our next guest, Suzanne Schulte. She is the president of a marvelous organization in Washington known as the Defense Forum Foundation. But she's going to particularly passionate interest and leadership role in trying to help the people of North Korea by chairing a project of the Defense Forum Foundation known as the North Korea Freedom Coalition. She is an exemplar of the sort of work that we're profiling in this program of Secure Freedom Radio, of people doing splendid humanitarian work and trying to make a real difference in terms of the threats that evil in the world represents to the rest of us. And Suzanne, welcome back. It's always good to have you with us, and thank you for the great work you do with the Defense Forum Foundation.
Frank. Great to be with you, Frank.
We have kind of a news peg about what's happening in North Korea at the moment. A woman by the name, I believe it's Myung-hee Bae, has been visiting there and was able to see her son, a Christian missionary, I guess, and a man who has been sentenced to 15 years of hard labor, which is quite possibly going to kill him. Talk a little bit about that episode and what it sort of calls to mind is needed in terms of exposing what the North Koreans are up to and how it might actually help someone like Kenneth Bae in his time of tribulation.
Here's the thing. Here's a gentleman who, because of his Christian beliefs, for 15 years was doing tours and doing things to promote North Korea, doing humanitarian missions there. And we don't know exactly what happened, but whatever he did, he became an enemy of the state. I believe it's because he took pictures of children that were emaciated and starving, and that's what got him into trouble. But this is just appalling that an American citizen who was doing good works is being held in, you know, basically in prison in North Korea, and we should be basically demanding his release and suspending, you know, all relations with this country until this American is let, you know, allowed to come home.
Yeah. But I'm reminded, Suzanne, of the work that was done back in the darkest days of the Cold War when refuseniks, not even American citizens, but just people of conscience, were being brutalized and tortured and incarcerated for, you know, protracted periods of time. And an effort was made by, among others, my old boss, Scoop Jackson, Senator Scoop Jackson, to call attention to their plight. And it had a real impact on how they were treated. Is that the case in your experience with even Korea as well?
Absolutely, especially now, because what you have is the information age has hit North Korea. People there are no longer isolated. It isn't a hermit kingdom anymore. They know the truth. They know the reality of their circumstances. It's more important now than ever to talk about these human rights violations, to talk about the fact that we know about the political prisoner camps, that we know that people are being executed for the crime of having religious faith or being tortured because they crossed the border to get food for their families. We need to be talking about this even more because they do hear about this information. They do hear about what we're saying. And it's very, very important.
I'm reminded that quite apart from whatever pressure the people of Korea might be able to bring on the government by knowing more about what it's doing, there's also some evidence, at least, that the North Koreans respond to bad publicity with respect to these prisoners when it's made known in the West that they are brutalizing them. What's your experience with that, and could that help here as well?
I absolutely believe that getting this information out about what we know what's going on in these political prison camps, they can't deny it anymore. They've been denying it, you know, for ever since the foundation of the North Korea regime. But exposing this is very critical. They can't deny it any longer because of two things. Number one, because there are so many eyewitnesses that have come out now. There's so many people that can testify that were survived these political prison camps. There's also a young man that came out that was actually born in the camp, spent his whole life in the camp. So now we know that there are children in these political prison camps. But also the satellite photos that have been released by the Committee for Human Rights in North Korea has shown these expansive camps. So I think it's very important to speak out about the basically calling for these camps to be shut down, at the very least for the Red Cross to be able to visit these camps, which is something that's been talked about as a way to kind of open up, you know, the door. But it's absolutely critical. And as you point out, during the Soviet Union, people being held in the Soviet gulag. Solzhenitsyn talks about how important it was when the West was speaking out about the labor camps in the Soviet Union.
Yes, indeed. You have been speaking out, of course, but interestingly, the United Nations has now got a commission of inquiry that made a rather powerful indictment of what they call unspeakable atrocities in North Korea. This would seem to be perhaps reaching critical mass at last. Suzanne, this must be heartening given the hard work you've put on in this for so many years with seemingly little response from either our own government or international community more generally, to say nothing of North Korea.
And this commission just started their the hearings in the summer. They visited Tokyo and Seoul, and they've already come to the conclusion that they're halfway through their investigation, and they've already come to the conclusion that crimes against humanity have been committed in North Korea and are being committed in North Korea. They are coming to Washington, the USA, in October, and we're actually lining up some witnesses to testify in particular about what's happening. The political prison camps are now well known. We also want to talk about people that we know that were tortured simply because they crossed the border and left the country without permission, which is considered a crime against the state. We also have a woman who's agreed to testify who, during the famine years, she started a business, which, of course, you're not allowed to have your own business. She was arrested, and she thought she was being arrested because she'd started this business, but it turned out there was a rumor that she'd become a Christian. So she was tortured in detention for several weeks until she could prove to them that she'd never become a Christian. I'm pleased to report that she's a pastor now. She's a North Korean Christian pastor. But she's going to testify when the commission comes to Washington about people of anybody that shows any kind of doubt towards the regime, not showing full loyalty to the regime, will be arrested and tortured and detained.
Yeah. Suzanne Schulte is our guest. She is the president of the Defense Forum Foundation and chairman of the North Korea Freedom Coalition. And Suzanne, just very quickly in the remaining minute or so we have with you, what can people do to help you and the work that you're doing to assist these defectors or others, prisoners of conscience or otherwise, in North Korea at the moment?
We have so many exciting things that we're working on. We do a lot of, we do radio broadcasting in North Korea, which Frank, how important radio is. We have the most popular radio station that's ever broadcast into North Korea, a non-governmental. It's done by defectors that produce the program. We've got an international campaign going on right now to try to get China to stop their brutal repatriation policy. If your listeners could visit www.nkfreedom.org, there's a petition they can sign to Xi Jinping that we're going to be delivering December 10th at International Human Rights Day. We're out calling.
That's the Chinese Prime Minister.
Exactly, and we hope that the Chinese people are on our side on this. They think the policy of kowtowing to the Kim Jong Un regime is not good for China. They enjoy K-pop, South Korean culture. President Park is very popular there, and so we're saying stop this brutal policy you have of forcing North Koreans back there trying to cross to get to South Korea, and in some cases their family members that have already escaped, and we've got a campaign going on, so we'd love to get people involved with that. And there's a YouTube video that we just released that's got an interview with three people that crossed the border. It's very short. It's just about 5.5 minutes. So we'd love for people to look at that to see the reality of what is happening. These are three North Koreans that crossed the border. They kind of tell their story about why their families fled.
Yeah. All of this sounds fantastic. NKFreedom.org is the website. It talks about the work of the North Korea Freedom Coalition to one whose chairman, Suzanne Schulte, is for this segment. I hope that you will continue to keep us abreast of what you're doing, Suzanne. It is incredibly important, especially your insight that China is kowtowing in the eyes of its people to North Korea. It certainly is enabling this regime, and whether it's kowtowing or whether it's simply underwriting its horrific work, it must come to an end, and we're grateful to you for shedding light on it. Keep up the work, as always. We'll look forward to talking with you again soon. We'll look forward to talking with the rest of you again next week, same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Affney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.